Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, it is the Friday News Roundup. Vineyard Wind has logged another victory in its legal dispute with GE, and we'll soon be learning more about how to navigate around the Sagamore Bridge during construction. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is here with those stories. Hi, Jeanette.
Good morning, Mindy.
A few weeks ago, a state Superior Court judge reconsidered his original decision in favor of Vineyard Wind. The offshore wind company is suing its turbine supplier, GE Renewables. Now we have the judge's decision. Can you start by giving us an overview of what happened here?
Yes. Well, the headline here is that the judge affirmed his previous decision, saying that GE cannot stop work on Vineyard Wind. This case is part of the fallout from the defective turbine blades that were discovered in 2024. That's when one blade shattered in place and it littered fiberglass on many of our beaches here, mostly on the islands, but also some on the Cape. The two companies, Vineyard Wind and GE, are fighting over the money damages from that. GE tried to terminate its contracts and walk away before the turbines are up to full capacity. The judge in this case, Judge Peter Krupp in Superior Court, he initially sided with Vineyard Wind, said GE could not walk away. GE asked him to reconsider that in light of some things that happened afterward, after the initial decision. Vineyard Wind declared that it had begun commercial operation. But the judge said that starting commercial operation really made no material difference to the underlying issues in the case.
Okay.
By the way, I just want to make a quick note here about the company name. GE Renewables is the entity named in the lawsuit. It is essentially the same as the global energy company GE Vernova, as in successor to the old General Electric. GE will only say that GE Renewables is, quote, part of the company. They don't describe it as a subsidiary or anything like that, and they don't really answer direct questions about that issue. So, you know, GE Renewables, it's a name within GE, but it is the same company that most people think of.
What else did the judge say about why he was ruling in favor of Vineyard Wind?
Well, he agreed with Vineyard Wind's claim that it really needs GE's expertise here. The turbines are installed, but they are not all fully operating, generating, you know, power at the capacity for which they're rated. And the judge says he believes that Vineyard Wind needs the proprietary know-how, as he put it, from GE to bring those turbines up to capacity. He also said Vineyard Wind continues to be at risk of losing financing if this work doesn't continue.
So there was a second issue in this case, arbitration over the money, right? And the judge ruled on that too?
Yes. GE was trying to force Vineyard Wind to go to arbitration over who owes what related to that blade failure. If you recall, what happened was Vineyard Wind withheld payments to GE because GE owed damages as determined by an engineer. GE disputes the damages, but the judge says, or he declined to force Vineyard Wind into arbitration. So that was another victory for Vineyard Wind.
So where does the situation go from here?
Likely it's going to appeals court. We don't know that for sure. One of the parent companies of Vineyard Wind, which is Avangrid, would not comment on this. A spokesman for GE Vernova told me they're looking forward to their next steps. He would not say what any of those next steps are, but the normal venue to pursue something like this further would be state appeals court.
And yet another wind-related lawsuit was filed this week, too.
That's right. This is a brand new federal lawsuit against the Trump administration by seven states. New York is leading it, but it also has New Jersey and all of the New England states except New Hampshire. They are suing the Trump administration for, as they say, paying an offshore wind company to cancel two offshore wind leases off the state of New York. What the Trump administration is doing essentially is refunding the developers' money that they paid for the wind leases. That is to the tune of about $1 billion. And they're doing that on the condition that the developer then invests the money in fossil fuel projects instead. This company is called Total Energies. It's from France. So again, this is a regional and national lawsuit filed here, but I wanted to mention it because Massachusetts is involved and it could have some implications for what happens to other wind lease areas.
All right, let's talk about the latest on the Cape Cod Bridges replacement project. You have some news about navigating around the construction.
Yes, the state says they're creating a concept drawing of how people can get around the Sagamore Bridge construction on the Canal Service Road, aka the Canal Bike Path. So we are talking about cyclists and pedestrians. There are many of them, of course, who use that path a lot there along the Cape Cod Canal. The engineers are working on a design to make it sa safe to pass through that area during the construction, and they are planning to unveil that design on July 23rd at Bourne High School. The time of that meeting, though, has not yet been announced.
All right, so stay tuned. CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Thank you, Jeanette.
Thanks, Mindy.
Meteorites fell into Cape Cod Bay on Saturday when a meteor exploded into a fireball about 30 miles up in the atmosphere. Here to tell us more about that is CAI's Gilda Geis. Hi, Gilda.
Hey, Mindy.
All right, some people in our area did, they either heard or saw the fireball on Saturday. So take us through what happened.
Sure. So I just want to start by making sure everyone understands the difference between a meteor, a fireball, and a meteorite, because I didn't when I started reporting this story.
Neither do I.
So here's Liam Peterson, a scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution.
A meteor is an object that whose orbit crosses Earth and enters the atmosphere. When we say fireball, that is the burn-up event that happens when the object basically heats up and starts to disaggregate. In the case of this one, it exploded. And you get that big pulse of light. And then when they're going fast enough, you compress the air and then you get the sonic boom.
And then whatever's left on the ground, or in this case, on the seafloor of Cape Cod Bay, is called a meteorite. So on Saturday around 2 p.m., a meteor entered the Earth's atmosphere at what NASA scientists think was a pretty steep angle, which they think caused it to fall especially quickly, around 42,000 miles per hour. Scientists believe that the higher speed then caused the fireball to happen at a higher altitude, around 30 miles up, as you said, which is apparently about twice as high as what's typical. Some people saw the fireball. A couple people even caught it on video. We actually have one of the videos linked in the article that I wrote about this on our website, capeandislands.org. It was very quick and kind of looked to me like what you might imagine a shooting star would look like, but falling straight downwards. The high speed of the meteor also created a sonic boom, which some people heard, and more than 80 people ended up sending their eyewitness reports to the American Meteorological Society, which helped scientists learn more about the meteor.
And so what else did the HUI scientists tell you about the fireball event?
Yeah, so because the meteorites fell into Cape Cod Bay, I was curious about how they might impact the water from kind of an ecological standpoint. So I reached out to HUI and they put me in touch with Liam. He's a postdoctoral investigator in the geology and geophysics department. So I spoke to him about 48 hours after the event, and at that time we knew very little about the meteorites. We know some more now. So at that time, he guessed that they were likely made up of material similar to lava and would not pose an ecological threat to the bay. But even if his guess was wrong, he said, there still probably wouldn't be an impact on the ecosystem. Here's Liam again.
In diameter, even if it was like a pure contaminant, say it was like pure mercury, the relative mass of the body of water relative to the object that size, even if it fully dissolves, it's unlikely to constitute a significant contaminant source.
Now, NASA recently released some new information based on density calculations. They think these are iron meteorites, which, as the name suggests, are made up mostly of an iron-nickel alloy. So the vast majority of meteorites are a type they call stony meteorites, containing mostly silicon-based minerals. So that's another aspect that made this event sort of unusual.
So fascinating. Is anyone trying to get the meteorites from the bottom of the bay?
So a NASA spokesperson told the Boston Globe that trying to get those samples would require a lot of resources, and any samples they recovered would likely be too contaminated by the ocean to have enough scientific value to make it worth it, basically. NASA says, in theory, you could go out on a boat with a long rope with a magnet on one end and try to get them that way. And iron meteorites are some of the most magnetic kinds of meteorites. The meteorites are also estimated to be quite a bit larger than typical meteorites, so I'm not sure how that would impact any endeavor to recover the pieces. But if anyone listening has tried, please give us a call to let us know how it went.
I need a very big magnet.
I suppose so. And one additional fun fact I'll mention that Liam pointed out to me is that the American Meteorological Society has apparently observed a significant increase in fireball events in the first quarter of 2026. They really want to find out more about why this is happening, and eyewitness reports really help them do that. So you can find a link to report your observations in my article about the meteor on our website, capeandislands.org.
Fascinating. CAI's Gilda Geist. Thank you, Gilda.
Thank you.
All right. There's a new kind of shark to be wary of if you're swimming off Nantucket's Great Point. CAI science and environment reporter Amy Kolb-Noyes is here to tell us about that. Oh, goody.
Good morning.
Yay. Good morning, Mindy.
All right. So why are the shark scientists sounding the alarm over dusky sharks?
Well, the short answer is that they behave a lot like white sharks. Local shark researchers documented for the first time dusky sharks hunting seals off Nantucket in 2023. Before that, Megan Winton, who's a senior scientist at the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy, said seals weren't a known part of their diet. Here's some of what Winton had to say about that discovery.
We've been getting sightings of large sharks in that area for a few years prior to 2023, but that was the first year we actually received photos and videos from the public that allowed us to determine that these weren't white sharks, that these were dusky sharks, and launched this whole investigation.
So as part of that investigation, they sent some drones up out over Great Point and actually got footage of those dusky sharks attacking a seal. I saw that footage. It was pretty gruesome. The population, as far as we know, is localized to that area around Nantucket's Great Point. Dusky sharks have not been spotted off the Outer Cape, where we tend to see white sharks. But Winton says the precautions are the same for anyone swimming in the ocean around here.
It's very well established at this point that white sharks, and now we know dusky sharks, are coming here to feed on seals, and we know they hunt for them in shallow water close to shore. So when you go to the beach, pay attention to the lifeguard's messaging. You don't want to swim with shark food.
You don't want to swim with shark food.
No,
so,
for sure.
So by that she means don't swim with seals or with large schools of fish, and also beware of the depth where you're swimming because sharks tend to hunt right along the drop-off edge.
What else can you tell us about dusky sharks? I'd never heard of them before, and then why are they showing up now?
Yeah, so they're large gray sharks. They're a species of requiem shark, like bull sharks, tiger sharks, and blue shark. Winton described them to me as the typical shark you think of when you think of a Florida shark. They can be up to 14 feet long. They're migratory, but they typically stick to warm water, so this is definitely the northern tip of their range. Their population took a big hit globally due to overfishing, and now they're a protected species, and those protections are widely credited for the population's rebound, which could be why they've been observed here over the past several years. Or it could be, like the white sharks, they're just following the seals.
All right. CAA science and environment reporter Amy Kolb-Noyes. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you, Mindy.
Coming up, Nantucket School Committee serves some unusual brownies to make a point. Stay with us. And you're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. The Nantucket School Committee was presented with a plate of brownies that prompted a police report. Jason Grazzi today from the Nantucket Current has more. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
All right, tell us what happened.
Well, this is a strange one for sure. The school committee meeting was getting underway earlier this week. Pretty normal agenda, normal, opening to the meeting, public comment opened, and the chair, Laura Gallagher-Byrne, recognized Megan Perry, who is a familiar name to folks on the island as a government critic and a someone who has raised concerns about the installation of the proposed artificial turf field, which is slated for Vito Capizzo Stadium at Nantucket High School. And, you know, they've raised a number of concerns about PFAS and whether the field will potentially contaminate the drinking water and the groundwater around the area. So Megan gets up, begins to speak, and offers the school committee a plate of brownies. And they happily accepted them. And then she said, told them that you know, it is my understanding they do have a non-detect level of X-lax in them, but I figured since we're okay with a non-detect level of PFAS, it would probably be okay. So this obviously kind of rattled the school committee. Not sure if it was a joke, not sure if it was real. She was obviously trying to draw a metaphor regarding the testing standards of the PFAS, the artificial turf field, and whether there's levels of PFAS that are below the testing detection thresholds that the school system plans to use. But the school committee members were clearly upset by this, weren't sure if there were actually, you know, a laxative in the brownies. And yesterday, the school committee chair, Laura Gallagher-Byrne, she would be filing a police report regarding the incident. So obviously sort of raising the profile of this sort of stunt even more. And obviously it's since, you know, gone a bit viral and, you know, people sharing it all over. So another episode here related to the turf field on Nantucket.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because she served the brownies with a smile on her face, right? And you went, wait, and the school committee members looked a little stunned. Right.
Yeah. And obviously they were, you know, kind of on alert because of Megan Perry's prior opposition to, you know, the turf field, and has been a critic of the school committee and has, you know, done some other things at public comment period for the select board of a similar vein. So I think they were, you know, sort of on alert already. And then the brownies came in, and then she made the comment about the laxative. So just a bizarre episode at our local school committee meeting.
And now the police report has not been filed yet. And why a police report? And were they going to be testing the brownies to actually see if there's any traces of a laxative in them?
Yeah, we understand that the brownies were actually thrown away. So I don't know that there will be any testing.
No,
I don't know
evidence.
And I would be highly doubt that anything comes out of a any sort of investigation or criminal action. But Laura Gallagher-Byrne, the school committee chair, said she was advised by the town to file a police report given what happened. And, you know, her quote, you know, her statement that she gave to us, you can find on our website. But, you know, just that this was, you know, concerning to them, and felt that it was appropriate given the background to file a police report.
And then another story you have this week is about a new principal.
Yeah, sort of more traditional school news week. But the Nantucket Elementary School has named a new principal. Michael Stanton is going to be taking over for retiring Nantucket Elementary School principal Kim Kubish. Stanton comes to us from the Foxborough, Massachusetts area elementary school, and the Charles G. Taylor Elementary School in Foxborough. And he was one of two candidates that were finalists for this position, and came sort of highly recommended from the school administration here. And we've also been hearing from a lot of folks from the Foxborough area, from his school, who, you know, almost universally are telling us that Nantucket is lucky to have him, and they're sad to see him go, and excited for Nantucket to have the elementary school come under his leadership.
Yeah, a lot of experience there. And I've been wondering, has he found a place to live?
Yeah, we're going to be talking with him about that, but I'm sure that was part of the negotiations and discussions that he's had with the school committee, and you don't take a job like that without having something lined up.
Yeah. All right, Jason Gratz today from the Nantucket Current. Thank you, Jason.
Thanks for having me on.
Mashpee regulators deny a proposed Trader Joe's. Callie Millard from the Enterprise Newspapers is here with more. Hi, Callie.
Hi.
All right, so I can hear this collective sigh, both from those who want Trader Joe's and those who do not, right?
Yes. So it has been a long 7 months of hearings, but the vote was officially taken on Wednesday night. It was about 3 hours into the meeting, so people were in there for the long haul, but it did not clear the supermajority hurdle it needed. It only got 3 yeses from board members and 2 noes and needed 4. Yeses to pass.
Yeah. And what was the argument for voting against it?
It's largely focused around really just the location. Remember Karen Faulkner is the one who introduced the motion to deny. And what she said is that, you know, it fits on paper, but when you look with your eyes at the operation of the site, how the whole corridor functions, you know, it's just it was not going to work. It was going to push the whole area over capacity. There were going to be traffic concerns. She specifically mentioned, you know, the propensity for an increase of rear endings and, you know, possible collisions with pedestrians or cyclists. So, yeah, they ultimately knocked it down because of the traffic and safety concerns that we've been hearing about these last 6 or 7 months.
So it's not against Trader Joe's in itself. I mean, pretty much universally, everybody wants a Trader Joe's.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So is there another location that it could be considered?
I would like to see another location be considered. I do know that the developer does own this parcel. So now it's really, you know, once the decision is filed, they're going to work on, you know, tidying all that up and officially filing the denial. But the developer does have the opportunity to appeal the decision. There's a 21-day appeal period. So that is also a possibility. But, I mean, my personal opinion, I think any other site is worth looking at. It was just, it was never going to work.
Yeah.
Really.
And I mean, there are a lot of people have mentioned potential other sites, right? But I guess the thing is here, the developer doesn't own that property.
Yeah.
Right. So there's that sort of wrinkle.
Yeah. There's the difficult, you know, kind of run around. But we've heard a lot from, we shared the news, you know, as soon as it came out on Wednesday night, and hundreds of people chiming in on Facebook and Instagram and other social media, very upset about the denial. So
and who knows? Maybe there'll be some other surrounding towns. Falmouth, perhaps.
Falmouth, perhaps. You're not the first person to float that.
All right. I know you'll stay on it. Callie Remillard from the Enterprise Newspapers. Thank you, Callie.
Thank you.
A waterfront improvement project in Chatham may cost more than expected. Tim Wood joins us from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Mindy.
So we talked about the excitement of the return of the former Stage Harbor Coast Guard boathouse back in March. Now the reality of what it might cost to renovate.
Yeah, it sort of hit like a ton of bricks the other day when they got the bids in for both their two separate projects involved here. One is renovation and restoration of the boathouse, which is the historic Stage Harbor Coast Guard boathouse. As you said, it recently, this winter, it was brought back to Chatham after being away for 9 or so years. And it's been situated at 90 Bridge Street, and it's ready to be upgraded. The bids for that project came in at about $300,000 higher than had been expected. Now, the good thing is that the budget can absorb that amount of money. So the select board actually went ahead and awarded that contract, which is for $2.7 million. The problem is that, you know, the point of having this new building is to serve as a new home for the town's shellfish grow out system, its upweller. And the other aspect of this project that was recently bid was sort of putting together the mechanical aspects of the upwelling system, which, you know, grows out shellfish, and there's a lot of pumps and seawater intakes involved. And the town had anticipated that that was going to cost about $1.2 million, but those bids came in 85% higher at over $2.7 million.
Wow, yeah.
So, and that can't be absorbed in the budget. So the town has rebid that portion of the project. They went through, according to Greg Berman, who's the natural resources director, they went through it with a fine-tooth comb with the engineers and the owner's project manager to try to pare back those elements and to see where they could find savings. And they've put that out to bid again. The bids are actually due back today. Mm-hmm. And they're sort of under a deadline because the town has a grant from the State Food Security Infrastructure Program. And some of that grant, which goes towards the upweller, has to be spent in the current fiscal year, which ends at the end of this month.
Oh, boy.
So under a bit of a deadline there. So we'll see what the bids come out to today on that, and we'll be reporting that in next week's paper.
Yeah, keep our fingers crossed. All right, so many school districts are grappling with declining enrollment in older buildings. In Orleans, 5 scenarios were presented to improve operations with the Nauset Public Schools. Tell us what's going on there.
Sure. This involves the elementary schools in the Nauset district. And currently, there are elementary schools in Orleans, Eastham, and Wellfleet, and 2 in Brewster. And over the past year, there's been a 12-member steering committee looking at the benefits, if possible, of some kind of consolidation there. And because a number of those buildings, especially in Orleans and Brewster, need some work. And before going ahead with renovations or replacement of the buildings, the town officials and school officials want to know if they're going to be useful in the future. So they came up with five different scenarios, which have different mixes of elementary schools. Some involve just renovating the existing buildings. Some involve consolidating. For instance, the two Brewster schools into one building, or breaking up the elementary population into sort of grade two to kindergarten to grade two and grade three to grade five and putting them in different schools in different towns. Those estimates for the work that would be required in those five different scenarios range from $30 million to $75 million. So these are big ticket items. Right now, this report is being aired in all the different Nauset towns. Orleans had its turn on Tuesday, and Brewster, I believe, was last night. And there's going to be, obviously, a lot more discussion and study before they can determine where to go with this situation.
Yeah, and of course, the price of renovation always keeps going up and up, right? You get one figure, and then you wait a little bit, and that figure gets a little bit higher. And this is something school districts across the Cape are probably even beyond are looking at because affordable housing plays into this, too. You know, many families leaving the Cape, and we're seeing those numbers decline.
Yeah, definitely enrollment is the big issue here. One of the things that this study looked at was projected enrollment, and they're projecting that the student population in the Nauset district in the elementary grades is going to drop from almost 2,000 to about 1,800 over the next few years. Mm. So, you know, that plays a big role in all of this. And there are a lot of affordable housing projects on the books, but those take years to come to fruition. So, you know, whether those will add to the student population is going to have to be a factor that they look at here.
Remain to be seen. All right. Brewster, and then Brewster overcharged by the Nauset School District. This was quite a bit of money.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation. Over the last, I think about just the last 3 years, the finance committee in Brewster calculated that the town has been overcharged by almost $400,000. And that stems from an error that was made almost a decade ago, where the debt for this Nauset school system was supposed to be calculated with a different formula than the usual annual cost assessments. And over a period of time, nobody's quite sure how this happened, but the debt formula kind of dropped off, and they started calculating that based on the usual formula, and that resulted in an overcharge to Brewster of, like I said, almost $400,000. And what they've decided to do is they're gonna pay what they're assessed during the current year and next year because those budgets have already been set. So they're gonna sort of overpay this year, and then they're gonna work with the district to seek sort of corrected assessments and discounts to make up for that overassessment.
All right. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks very much, Mindy.
The Provincetown Select Board asking the police chief to increase enforcement for drug trafficking. Paul Benson from the Provincetown Independent has more on this story. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Mindy.
So this is an issue that I think probably every town across the listening area is dealing with, right, is drug enforcement. So tell us what's going on in Provincetown.
I think there's a particular focus on methamphetamine in Provincetown, which has been a problem. It's tricky because it's fairly visible when people are heavy users of meth. You can kind of tell, but that doesn't mean you don't witness it, mm-hmm. but you can sort of see it on their face. So it's something that people in the community feel that they're aware of, but there's not a lot they feel being done about. And there has been, there was really all five select board members to know what the administration had a plan for to do more about meth trafficking in particular.
And what does the police chief say about it?
Right. So he took over a year ago and he said, well, we have rebuilt the detective unit. We had through attrition lost all three of our detectives. So now we have two new ones. They're dedicated only to investigations. He also said we're building more partnerships with other agencies. Because in a small town, it's really hard to go undercover for the kind of bust that you need to do trafficking. So you need to have partnerships with other police departments or people from a little further away who can do the undercover work to help get that kind of arrest.
I'm wondering, is the Cape Cod Drug Task Force still around? I don't even know. I mean, that was the work.
They are.
Yeah. So you would think that would be something they could help with. Yeah.
Yes. One of the detectives has been detailed to the task force, and that's a thing that he's highlighted as an ongoing effort to bring more cooperation. And he said there's a lot of interest in other agency partners in focusing on meth. It hadn't been as high a priority as, you know, heroin and opiates for a really long time. But he said other towns are coming around to meth as what we want to pay attention to. So it's easier to get help, he said, than it used to be.
Yeah. And do we have any statistical information on how bad the problem is?
Well, there were four overdose deaths in the last 2.5 years in Provincetown. We know at least two of those were methamphetamine overdoses. There a whole series of non-lethal overdoses, about 21 of those in the last 2.5 years. And then, of course, he had arrest numbers, about 24 for possession and 3 for trafficking in the last 2.5 years.
And then what about how they would measure success? You know, they're asking, the select board's asking for more enforcement. What are they, how are they going to measure the success of this, investigating trafficking?
It was a great question, right? Like what she said was, a year from now, what is the metric you're going to pick to let us know how the progress is going? And it could be number of investigations doesn't work, because if you realize all your suspects know each other, now you have one big investigation. You can talk about man hours, and I think they will probably report that, but we know we have two dedicated detectives who are only doing investigations. So he sort of did say, you will see some high profile arrests. So more or less by this time next year, you can expect to have seen that. And he also said, you know, there's the persistent problem of there's always going to be a supplier when the demand is really strong. And as a select board member said, people who are on this drug are extremely resourceful. It's a very, very addictive substance, and they're going to find a way to get it. So you're sort of always going to be working to restrict supply when the demand for a drug is that persistent.
All right. Paul Benson from the Provincetown Independent. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Mindy.
Coming up, efforts to save the remaining elm trees in the Northeast. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. Voters on Martha's Vineyard made their voices heard in regards to upgrades at the regional high school. Ethan Gettner from the Vineyard Gazette has more. Hi, Ethan.
Hello, Mindy.
I guess you could call this a landslide, right?
Yeah. Of the about 4,000 plus voters who came out for this kind of single item election, 85% voted in favor of improvements over at the school.
Tell us about what's entailed in the improvements.
Yeah, so this is a $333.5 million project. It's the most expensive public works project in the island's history. What it's going to do is build a whole new wing over at the regional high school, which is in not the best shape over there. We've kind of heard some of the ways the teachers and students are making it work, but it seems like it's really deteriorating, and also involves a large renovation of the existing building over there.
Is it unusual to have a vote in all six towns?
This is the first time we've ever done this, not a regular election, and just a single item island-wide. All the polls were open from 11 to 7 p.m., and it was the first time we've ever done this. They could have also done the town meeting process, you know, get votes in all the six towns out here and then do an election. But they sought this way as, you know, kind of a different method that's allowed under the state laws.
Yeah. And so when would the work begin and when would it be completed?
Yeah. So now we're going to kind of, you know, finalize some of the design aspects of this project. And all it's going to be like 199,000 square feet. And the idea is to have it kind of get the shovels in the ground maybe by next spring. And then it's going to take probably a couple of years. And the hope is not to have anybody, any of the students in trailers like we had over in Tisbury here on the island. So, yeah, it's going to be a big undertaking, but they expect it to kind of get underway next year.
All right. Ethan Gettner from the Vineyard Gazette. Thank you, Ethan.
Thanks, Mindy.
The Attorney General sues United Healthcare over alleged fraud. The saga of Diana DiZiaglio's attempt to audit the state legislature continues, and the House weighs in on data privacy. CAA's Gilda Geist checks in with our State House reporter, Katie Lannon.
Attorney General Andrea Campbell is suing United Healthcare over alleged fraud involving a healthcare program for seniors. Can you tell us more about the AG's allegations?
Sure. The Attorney General is charging that UnitedHealthcare essentially took at least $100 million from the state's MassHealth program over a 10-year period, essentially by portraying the members who are enrolled in their senior care options plans as sicker or in need of more care than they were in reality, and doing that to get higher payments from the state. So they, according to the lawsuit, allegedly the insurance company told MassHealth that some members needed daily skilled nursing services and that others had behavioral health conditions like depression or anxiety that they didn't have diagnoses or related treatments for in reality.
How has UnitedHealthcare responded so far?
Interestingly, the AG told us when she announced this suit that her office hadn't been able to settle with UnitedHealthcare. So it looks like this could really be a court battle coming. United has called the suit meritless and says it doesn't accurately describe the senior care program. They say AG Campbell is just wrong, that these seniors shouldn't be getting this care. So it looks like we could be gearing up for quite a court fight here.
All right. And on this segment, we've been following the saga of State Auditor Diana DeSoglio's attempts to audit the state legislature. So what's the latest development with that?
Yeah, and it has been quite a saga in the 18 months since this ballot question passed. We've seen some really big steps taken just in the past week, though. The House of Representatives, which has refused so far to comply with the audit request from Diana DeSoglio, passed new legislation this week that would essentially set limits around what kind of documents DeSoglio could access in her review. It's a limited set of financial papers that lines up with the same type of records the state Senate has already agreed to provide her. But in taking this move, the House is seeking to change state law, to write these new rules for the audit into state law. DeSoglio, you might be able to guess, is not pleased with this. She says that their move is akin to taking the 2024 ballot law, throwing it in the dumpster, and lighting that dumpster on fire. We still need to see if the state Senate goes along with the House's legislation. They both have to pass it to become law, and ultimately what the governor thinks. Some of the, at least one Republican, Brian Shortsleeve, who's running against her, has called for her to veto that bill if it reaches her desk.
All right. And finally, the House could vote soon on a data privacy bill. How does that bill seek to protect user privacy, and how likely do you think it is to pass?
Yeah, this has to do with the way big tech companies collect and sell or transfer your personal data. This legislation would create a requirement that you be able to opt out clearly from your data being sold. It's based on legislation that the state Senate has already passed. So even though there's differences between the two bills, there's a big interest in getting this done. The House's point person on technology, Rep. Tricia Farley Bouvier, says that data privacy underpins all the other tech legislation they might consider in the future, and that needs to be done first. Of course, it's worth noting this is separate from the school cell phone ban and youth social media restrictions the legislature is also considering. So there's a lot of technology issues at play all at once.
All right. That's Katie Lannon from the State House. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And the Atlantic horseshoe crab could become the official invertebrate of Massachusetts. That's one bill among 16 others looking to create more state symbols under review this legislative session by state lawmakers. Horseshoe crabs are iconic on Cape Shores, so their populations have been in decline. They are used as bait, and their blood is also used for medical testing. Cape Cod Times is reporting. Also under review, American lobster is being proposed as the official crustacean of Massachusetts. Well, if you took a walk along the banks of a river in New England 100 years ago, you'd likely find yourself looking up at towering American elm trees. 50 years ago, a fungus wiped out most of these trees, but a few survived. Now scientists want to use these survivor trees to bring back American elms. Vermont's Publix Abigail Giles visited southwestern Vermont to learn more.
Walking down the hill to the Nature Conservancy's preserve in Benson is like descending into a sea of American elm saplings.
We have these trees that are almost 10 years old, 5,200 trees here on site that have been babied and are absolutely beautiful now.
That's Forest Service scientist Lila Wilson. She knows these little trees well. Each one comes from a seed she harvested from a tree that she hand-pollinated using pollen collected in the lab.
They represent 53 large survivor elms from New England, so a lot of good genetic diversity here. And we're going to be infecting them with the Dutch elm disease fungus. So drilling a little hole into each tree and then injecting a solution that contains 100,000 spores of the fungus into each tree. I feel like we should warn them and apologize to them because we're torturing them and it's not nice. I don't like that part.
Dutch elm disease started killing American elms in the 1930s. It's spread by beetles that feed on their twigs. From there, the fungus infiltrates the tree's vascular system, clogging up the xylem. These are the vessels that carry water up into the tree's leaves, like arteries. As the fungus spreads, the vessels cauterize, and the leaves, the canopy of the tree, die. It's a little like heart disease. But just like in humans, some trees appear to have more resilient vessels. They survive. And Lila is hopeful that some of these saplings will make it too.
How long will it take to sort of ascertain who is resistant and who's not? Yeah, so we'll be back in about 8 weeks to start raiding the canopies. That'll give us a pretty good idea.
All in all, it'll take about 2 years to see which trees make it. American elms are big, long-lived trees with roots that can survive being underwater for weeks at a time and slow down floodwaters. A 2022 University of Vermont study found that planting trees like elms in floodplains could save Vermont $1 billion over the next century and cut flooding damage by almost 20%. Gus Goodwin is a scientist from the Nature Conservancy who is caring for the elms in Benson. From the nursery, he points out an adult elm that was killed by Dutch elm disease on the border of the neighboring hayfield. The top of the tree is curled up and bare, like a witch's broom.
What do we lose when we lose a big, beautiful, mature tree? I think because it's such a beloved piece of our cultural history and planted throughout so many towns and so many of our civic spaces, there's that kind of like community loss too.
The Nature Conservancy is helping the Forest Service with the funding for this research. And if it's successful, Gus hopes it will create a seed stock that people can use to restore floodplain forests across New England. Just over the fence from the nursery, he points out a big, healthy American elm. This one could be hundreds of years old. Shaped like an overflowing vase, it towers over the saplings the scientists are inoculating with spores. And it's a sort of reminder of what used to be.
And then there's just something special about walking into a forest with big trees that's messy, that has all this kind of complexity and diversity, and you know, everywhere you look it's just a little different and interesting and exciting, and you can't get that without big trees.
Scientists hope they can bring a little of that carbon-rich mess back to New England's riverbanks. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Abigail Giles.
We're just over a week out from the first of 7 World Cup matches in Boston, and one question looming is who will show up for the games and how will people pay for them? Some tickets for the France-Norway match on June 26 are going for a whopping $6,000. For most folks, just getting to these World Cup games across North America is an obstacle. Jerry Hedden with The World made some calls to fans overseas to ask what it cost them to come.
Hello.
Hello, Gustavo.
Hi, how are you?
I'm not bad.
I start out calling an old friend in Peru, Gustavo Salinas. He used to live in Barcelona. We watched a lot of soccer together in the golden era of Leo Messi. I ask him to make a fantasy budget, 2 weeks in Canada to catch some World Cup matches there.
What I need you to do is crunch the numbers to see if, even with free tickets, you could conceivably afford to go or accept spending that much money.
Okay, I understand.
And I guess maybe that.
While Gustavo's looking up prices for flights from Lima to Toronto, plus hotels, transportation, food, I check in with Basti Bomke, a pal in Munich, Germany. I was going to ask him for his budget, say, to Mexico, but he says we can just skip that.
since I live in Munich and I know what a hotel room costs when it's not Oktoberfest time, but when Oktoberfest is on, they charge you 10 times the prices. So I imagine that's the same when you go to a city where a football game or a World Cup football game takes place.
Bormke is a huge football or soccer fan, and yet...
it's just too much money, and it feels wrong. You know, football is a game for everybody. You know, that's what I like about football. You know, you just need a ball. You need two kind of goals, you know, sometimes in a park.
That simplicity is what earned soccer the moniker the beautiful game. The beautiful World Cup games, Bormke says, he'll watch those with friends on TV. Roya Shahidi is a reporter with Business Insider in London. She's been looking into the costs of getting to North America as well. Tickets aside, most everything is more expensive this round, she says. Flights, hotels, transportation to games. She says a lot of people have told her they are going.
But often they're kind of going to the FIFA World Cup and have tried to find the cheapest ticket, but it's not necessarily the team that they're wanting to go to. So there has been a lot of compromise, even with those people that were, you know, super, super keen to go to the US to see it this year.
That's the case for Efren Rueda, a Colombian living in Venezuela. I've been to 8 consecutive World Cups, he says, including all 8 finals. This will be my 9th. The cost for him and his son for 2 weeks in the U.S., about $13,500. And that doesn't include tickets to the final in New Jersey. They'll most likely be skipping that. The whole thing has become foul and vulgar, he says. Take our hotels. The average price is $400 a night. We're talking hotels that cost $100 a night normally, your typical Holiday Inn. Rueda says soaring costs will make this his last World Cup.
Hi.
Hi, Gustavo. ¿Qué tal?
¿Cómo estás?
Eventually, I called Gustavo Salinas back in Peru. He's run his numbers, over $7,000 for a whirlwind World Cup junket to Canada. His conclusion, he'd rather spend that money on something else.
I would have maybe a cruise somewhere else and have the football match in a boat, watching the sea between one match and the other.
And a beautiful big screen.
The big question now is, are there enough big spenders out there willing to splurge on the cup? It could be a wake-up call for the soccer industrial complex, from stadiums to subways to airlines and hotels, to think less about profits and more about ordinary people who'd love to see the games live.
And that's Jerry Haddon reporting in Barcelona. And that wraps up this week's News Roundup. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
A.D. Colburn of Woods Hole, captain of the Woods Hole Oceanographics research vessel, NOR.
The list of ports I have been to. Let's think. Let's start with the states. We'll go around the horn on the states. We did Seattle, Washington, Astoria, Oregon, San Diego, going down the coast, Manzanillo, Mexico. Where is that up in the Gulf of California? Guaymas, Mexico, Acapulco, Mexico, Puntarenas, Costa Rica. We did someplace in Guatemala, San Jose, Guatemala, possibly. Ecuador, Puntarenas, Chile. Panama Canal, many times, the very best, very best. The transit through the Panama Canal is much more fun than Suez Canal. And coming up the East Coast, well, lots of Gulf of Mexico, Florida, Charleston, South Carolina, Morehead City, North Carolina, New York City, Boston. Let's go east, Halifax, Nova Scotia, St. John's, Newfoundland, Reykjavik, Iceland, way up into the Arctic, both Labrador Sea and north of Iceland. Let's see, Scotland, Ireland, Southampton, England, into the Med. We've done Malta, we did Catania and Augusta, Sicily, Bari, Italy, through the Suez Canal, Seychelles, Mauritius, down the coast of Africa, Mombasa, Kenya, Cape Town, South Africa. The Easter Island did that. The Azores, I love the Azores. Hawaii of the Atlantic. Bermuda. You've been to Cape Verde. How's that? That's for starters.